and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And tonight our speaker is Deborah, and I've known her for a long, long time, and I'm really excited to get to hear her story because I've never heard it before. So with that, I'll give you Deborah.
My name is Deborah, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be here tonight. I got sober in this room, and it has a lot of memories for me, and I'm glad to see a few familiar faces from those days. I won't name names, Judy, Debbie, Tim, Frank was here, Nava. Forgive me if I missed anybody. And I have a friend who told me that when you tell your story, there's three stories you tell. The one you tell before, the one you tell during, and the one you wish you'd told. And I've had a lot of stories go through my head in the last month since I've known about this. And, you know, I tried to pare it down to just the essential. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on my childhood because I can get really stuck there. But I guess the essential thing to know about me and my childhood was that I had a father who was chronically ill and a mother who worked full-time and had a lot of unconditional love. And it created a kind of an erratic life for me, up and down emotionally. He was angry a lot, or silently angry, or openly angry, depressed, very locked into himself. So, you know, I was an only child, and I was out there adrift alone a lot, trying to figure out what it all meant. And the saving grace for me, there are actually two saving graces growing up in this situation. One was, for some reason, from a very, very early age, I had a belief in a higher power. I had a belief in God. And the other thing that was my saving grace was music. I had some talent in music, and my parents got me into music when I was very young, and I spent hours playing the piano, singing, got involved at school, got involved out of school in music, and that carried me through the turmoil of my family life. I really don't remember, there was no alcohol in our house, my parents didn't drink, although the legend goes that my paternal grandfather died actually drinking a bottle of poison because he thought, mistaking it for a bottle of alcohol. But of course we know today that's all pretty much about the same thing, isn't it? I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what was passed down to me. I had an uncle when I was 20 who died on my mother's side, who died of cirrhosis of the liver. And I remember her going out to, I think it was San Antonio where he lived, to see him. And she came back, he was dying in the hospital, and she came back home and she described him to me. It wasn't a pretty sight. I was about 20 at the time, and I was not drinking at this point in my life. And I remember thinking to myself, how in the world could anybody do that to themselves? I didn't have a clue. Within 10 years, I would be well on my way to becoming an alcoholic myself. But at the time, I had no idea the power of this disease and how it can overtake you once you start drinking if you have that allergy to alcohol. When I was 16, I went on an exchange program to France with my high school. And that's the first time I ever remember being exposed to alcohol. I didn't drink in high school. I was having too much. My high was music. You know, this was back in the 70s, and folk music was a thing, and I played the guitar, and I sang, and we went around and sang in churches and around town, and I just had more fun doing that. I didn't want to drink. But when I was in France, I was exposed to it all the time. You know, it's there, everywhere. And I remember one evening with the family I was staying with, and they were having a birthday party, and the French drink champagne for birthday parties if there's cake. That's just what they do. And I had a little glass of champagne, And I can remember to this day that something changed once I had that in my body. You know, some people say the world becomes technicolor. I felt like I was lifted off the ground, and I was lighter than air, and everything around me just had this glimmer to it. And I felt happy. You know, and I've known a lot of sadness growing up, and I felt the whole thing lift right off of me. But I also remember, and it's funny how you can be conscious of something that is going on inside you even when you're drinking. But I remember it cleaning the table with the family, and I was a little uncoordinated, and I dropped something on the floor, and it broke. And that's the memory that I carry with me today from that first high that I got from drinking. But I came back home, and I didn't seek it out. But I did want to go back to France. And I did go back to France. When I was 23 years old, I've been studying philosophy at Georgia State. And I think some of my, I've switched majors a lot, but I ended up in philosophy. And I think some of that, you know, I was trying to answer the really big questions. I wanted to know why. My father was very intellectual, and he raised me in an atmosphere of books, and, you know, and I wanted to know why. You know, why was there suffering? Who is God? You know, what is God? So I studied philosophy, and it wasn't working out at Georgia State. And I was interested in this French philosopher, so I thought, well, you know, it would be really nice to go back there. Well, I'm, you know, and this is the way God works in my life. He brings people into my life at different stages on the journey that are just meant to be there and are meant to be a part of it and further me along my path. So I met a young man, and he had exactly the same ideals that I did, and he wanted to go to France and study philosophy. So we went, we got married, of course, and we left together. And that's where my drinking history really, really began. It's there every day, morning. Well, some people do drink in the morning over there. Eventually, I would too. Afternoon, a big meal. Evening, a big meal. 7 days a week. You know, from a short period of time, I was drinking on a regular basis, more and more and more. And, you know, I had a great time, believe me. We had fun. That was my idea of fun, was sitting around a big table with a bunch of people discussing these ideas and drinking and smoking cigarettes and talking. It was just great. I loved it. But I think by the third year I was there, something had happened. And I, you know, that's my memory. My ex-husband might have a different memory of when that change started to occur. But I can remember by the third year, I was drinking more and more. I was drinking at night, sitting in the kitchen alone, listening to the radio, and crying and drinking. I was a crier and a drinker when I drank. So we came home after 5 years. And my father was getting really ill, and so we moved next to my parents, and I decided to work on some rental properties that they had. And, you know, I did a lot of the physical labor myself. You know, I was in my early 30s, and I had a lot of energy back then, and I was really driven to get some of these things done. So I would reward myself at night. You know, I just drank to my heart's content. So that was 1982. By 1988, and somewhere in there, I crossed the line. I don't know when it happened, but I know it happened. In 1987, my ex-mother-in-law, we found out, was drinking all her alimony money away with another drunk. And so we decided that we needed to bring her down here for treatment. I'm in total denial about my own alcoholism. But I'm like, oh, yeah, we need to bring her down here for treatment. And so she went to DeKalb Medical. It was called something else back then. And my ex-husband found a fellow student where he was going to school at Emory who was in the program who helped him get to Al-Anon meetings and get her into treatment and talk about alcoholism. Now, I imagine there was some talk about me too, wouldn't you? Within a year, we were divorced. And her disease of alcoholism pulled the covers on mine for him. You know, he was able to see at that point that he was married to an alcoholic and that it probably wasn't going to get better. So we split up. That was in August of 1988. That same, within a matter of days, my father died. And that began a period of really going downhill with alcohol for me. Because that's what I did for my grief, was I drank. I remember coming here with my ex-husband behind the curtain there to an Al-Anon meeting before we divorced. And I didn't have a clue. I was in total denial about my own drinking. You know, it took a few more years for me to have any awareness that I had a problem. And I can remember back when I was married to him, and it was probably towards the end of our marriage. I don't remember exactly. But, you know, in Fulton County we have these Herbies that you put on the side of the road that they come and pick up, you know, the sanitation workers. So one day, they're called Herbies in Fulton County. Herbie Kirby's, does that ring a bell for anybody out there? So, you know, I mean, we had gallon jugs of wine all the time. And one day he was late taking the garbage down, and he ran down the street. And the sanitation worker said to him, "Oh, you're the ones with all the wine." And he came back and told me. And do you know, from that day on, I decided that I had to hide my bottles from the sanitation workers. Now, I mean, normal people who drink don't do that. So what I did was I would put them all downstairs in boxes, and then after there was a reasonable amount of them, I put them in the trunk of my car, and I go around to different places in Buckhead and put them in the dumpsters. I mean, that's some form of insanity, you know. So what happened? You know, what happened to me to get me here? To bridge that gap between drinking alcoholically and desiring to do something about it, which is what happened. I got to that place. You know, like I said earlier, God puts people in my path. And he put two women in my path during those last 7 years of drinking. I met one of them at the old Y in Buckhead. We worked out together. And the boy she was dating at the time knew that we both spoke French, and he introduced us. And we became fast friends. And she was getting into another 12-step program. And for some strange reason, this was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. She was in between apartments. She needed a place to stay. And I thought about this for a couple of weeks. And a part of me knew that if she came to live with me, because I drank alone, basically, that somebody was going to find out. But I think there was some part of me that wanted to be discovered. I wanted somebody to know. It was kind of a veiled way of asking for help. So I asked her, I told her, "You can come stay with me for a few weeks." It was just going to be a few weeks. It turned out to be 3 months. And she used to leave her big book lying around. And she used to leave little notes on the kitchen counter for herself. You know, she was in another addiction, and she'd leave notes like "abstinence because I love myself." And I was like, "Oh, what does that mean?" But she had this big book she left on the couch in the den. And I remember one day going in there, and I just, you know, very gingerly decided to open it up and look at it. And I didn't want to get too close to it. So I stayed back. I really did. It was crazy. But I stayed back and I opened it. And I happened to open it to the page in How It Works, And the words that jumped off my page were, it's a program of spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. And I just felt this jolt go through me. And for some reason it spoke to me. And I thought, you know, there's something there. I might want to think about this. And I can remember, and this was the seed, that was a seed that was planted, but the zinger, you know, people who love you sometimes have a way of making zingers that you don't expect, and you kind of fall into the trap. I was one of those people, you know, I worked out a lot at that point. I ate a lot of tofu, and I drank large quantities of wine. Okay, I ate vegetarian food at Veggieland and drank wine. So we're sitting at dinner one night making, you know, the salad thing, and she's getting a piece of bread and she's putting butter on it. And, you know, this was back in the 70s when it was cholesterol was bad for you, right? So I said, Mimi, you know, butter's bad for you. And she looked straight at me and she said, there are worse things. And I know, and you know, the big jug of wine, the 3 gallon liter of wine or bottle is sitting there on the table. I knew exactly what she meant. And she did find an apartment a few months later and moved out. And we did have some conversations, you know. And I said, yeah, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna try and quit, you know. And the great thing about this particular friend was that she didn't cut me out of her life. We stayed friends, and we're still friends today, but probably because I'm in recovery, you know, but we wouldn't be friends if I weren't. But she didn't abandon me, and she loved me in a detached way from a distance, but she still maintained love for me, and I'm very grateful for that. And I always thank her when we go out and see her in Arizona, you know, for the gift that she gave me and of sharing her story with me and being there in my house. The other seed that was planted was another friend. I drank alone, except for once in a while before my divorce, I drank with another woman and we'd sit around and we would philosophize and talk. And sometimes I wish, we joke about this, that we wish we had a recording of what those conversations would like, because I'm sure they were, I mean, we thought we were brilliant, right? But I'm sure they were totally insane. And she got into the program several years before I did. And she called me early in January one year to say she picked up a white chip. Did I know what that was? I thought I kind of had a sense of what that might mean. And I said, well, I'm glad for you, but I really don't think I really need it. I'm not there yet. And she said something that went right through me and stayed in my mind for the remainder of my drinking. She said, just be careful. It might turn on you. And I never could forget that. The turning that it took on me was, eventually I started drinking in the morning. Or I'd wake up in the middle of the night. I don't know if this happened to you, but I'd wake up in the middle of the night. It was like the light bulbs were on like 200 watts and it was dark in the room. And I had to get up and have something to drink. And so I was drinking in the morning a lot. Not every day, but a lot. And I knew at that point that I was over the edge. It was gone. I had no power left over alcohol. It had beat me. You know, like I said, I drank alone. So the experience of desperation that came to me was an inner experience. It was a feeling of being completely lost in my own life, with no hope for change, no hope of my life ever getting any better. Because what alcohol did for me was it helped me create a fantasy about my life when I was drinking alone watching TV. But then I'd get up in the morning and nothing would ever change. And, you know, the comparison between those two got to be so intense that I had to face the truth about myself. In 1994, I was getting close to my bottom. I had a cancer scare, and I was a big coward, and I said, "Dear God," I made one of those foxhole prayers, "Dear God, if I just don't have cancer, I'll quit drinking." Right? So about 9 months later, after they'd done all the tests and cleared me and I was fine, I was still drinking. And this was in October of that same year. I spent the next couple of months in intense inner agony because I knew I had lied to God. And I just couldn't live with myself any longer. I had never tried AA. I had never been to an AA meeting. I tried every means that I knew of to quit drinking on my own. One of my last-ditch efforts was, I used to go to the old Oxford bookstore at Buckhead, if any of you all remember that, you know, and I'd buy all the self-help books, and, you know, I'd drink wine and read the self-help books, and then the next morning there'd be wine all over the self-help books, and I'd still be drunk, and then I'd start the same thing over the next day. So the last one I tried was called 6 Weeks to Sobriety. Isn't that a great title? No, so I just laughed. I read that thing from cover to cover, and I underlined, and they had these really complex diagrams of all the vitamins you were supposed to take. You had this problem or that problem. You're this type of alcoholic or that type of alcoholic. And way, 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 way in the back, it said, and you might want to try going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that was going to be the last resort, right? And I think I even called the hotline once or twice. And another one of my big excuses for not going to an AA meeting was I had asthma. And you all smoked. Let me take it. Asthma? The deadly disease of alcoholism. No, I was going to take the asthma. I was going to take the alcoholism. And I guess this was back in the 70s, early 80s, and before we didn't have non-smoking meetings. But in any event, January came of that year, and I was just in intense inner turmoil. And I finally made a decision that I was going to come to AA. Now, I believed in my heart, even before I got here, that this would work for me, because I had heard stories of people that it worked for. So I had that hope that's in the second step. I also, you know, I kind of postponed coming because I knew that once I came, I couldn't drink anymore. That's kind of, in my mind, that's how I saw it. So I kind of pushed it to the bitter end. But when I finally made the decision to come to my first AA meeting, of course, the day before, what did I do? I got drunk. I started in the morning. I passed out about 5:30, woke up about 10, then drank some more until I fell asleep, and then woke up the next day. Now, this was the miracle for me. When I woke up the next day, I still had the resolve to go to an AA meeting and not drink. And for some reason, I had chosen to go to an 8 o'clock meeting at Triangle, which was near my house. And I didn't drink that day. I didn't have the desire to drink that day. I felt, and I've heard the other people say this, but I felt something had changed. It was palpable. It was real. It was in my being. Something had changed. You know, I was later able to identify that when I read the doctor's opinion as a psychic change. Now, it happened for me when I made that decision, I was making a commitment. And I'm convinced that had I not followed through, you know, we don't just make commitments in AA, we follow them with action. If I had not followed through by coming to a meeting, picking up a white chip, I don't know if that compulsion would have stayed lifted. But I did follow through, and the compulsion stayed lifted. I picked up a white chip, and I came back the next day for a meeting. And the next day, and the next day, and the next day. I wouldn't say that the desire left me completely, but the compulsion, which I had had, I had gotten to a place where I had to drink. I could not drink. And that's what was driving me crazy. I could not drink. But the compulsion left. And so for the first 30 days, I went to Triangle. And then, actually, my very first meeting here at NABA was this meeting in 1995. And Bobby Jones told his story, and I still came back, if you know Bobby. So that's just a little inside joke, but he's a great guy. But I'm so grateful that I ended up here at NABA because there's so many wonderful people that were here at that time who gave me the wisdom of our program. And I have to really say this in honor of Beverly. I hope I don't cry. Beverly used to sit on that wall over there at the 11 o'clock meeting. 90% of what goes in and out of my brain about recovery, I learned from Beverly, sitting in every day at the 11 o'clock meeting. It was those simple things that she used to say that I clung to because, you know, I complicated everything. You know, being a philosophy student, we all do that as alcoholics, a lot of us, but I mean, I could slice and dice a sentence, a thought into a gazillion pieces. And that's what kept me out of action, was I would think too much. So, you know, one of the biggest aha moments for me in the program was when I heard the saying, you don't think your way into action, you act your way into thinking. It's the action that comes first, not the thinking. And I learned how to do that by coming to a meeting every day. I didn't just think about going to a meeting every day. I came to a meeting every day, and I listened to the old-timers. The big revelation for me when I first got here was that all I had to do was take it one day at a time. You know, back when I was drinking, I used to say, I am never going to drink again. And I would go downstairs to the basement, and I would get my stash of big bottles, and I'd march upstairs to the kitchen, and I'd pour them down the drain. And by 5:30 that evening, I was back in my car going over to Tower Liquor or to Greens or Kroger to buy some more alcohol. It never worked. But one day at a time was like, I thought, these people are just geniuses. You know, this is an amazing idea. It never would have occurred to me to break it down into segments like that and to pray today that I stay sober, thank God tonight that I stayed sober, get on my knees the next day and do it over again and go to a meeting. And that's what worked for me. And that's kind of how I did, my early sobriety. And I'm going to try and do this the way Tim emailed me to do it. I'm going to go through the steps real fast. Because I have to say I love the steps. The steps are what changed my life and continue to change my life. And I'm not perfect. But to me, they're the framework upon which I've been able to build a reasonably happy, sober life since I've been in AA. And, you know, I went to great lengths to find a philosophy of living. I mean, I moved across the ocean to find it. And here it was in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. And that's why, for me, I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic, because I've found a way to live. The one thing I love about step one is the word we. Because I get drunk, but we stay sober. To me, that's the great miracle and the great mystery of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was my experience, wasn't it? I kept getting drunk, trying to do it by myself. But when I decided and followed through on the decision to become a part of the we, I was able to stay sober one day at a time. Step two for me, you know, I believed in the higher power my whole life. So I was like, it was me and God, and I was trying to get sober. I was waiting to get struck sober by God, living alone, and it wasn't working. So for me, step two, I identify as my submission to God's will through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a, you know, there's a beautiful line in, at the end of step two in the 12 and 12 that says, every AA meeting is a guarantee that we will be restored to sanity if we relate rightly to God. And relating rightly to God to me is identified with being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step three, I've always had trouble turning everything over. How am I doing on time? Good? Good. Faith. You know, like I said, I've always believed in God, but I've always had a hard time trusting God to do the right thing. And some of that, you know, as I grew, I'm a very anxious person, and I've had panic attacks most of my life, and some of it may have been my early experience in childhood, which is a lot of trauma. But be that as it may, I trust the process of the 12 steps and the process of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how I turn my will and my life over to a power greater than myself. My first fourth step was a journey for me. It took me some time to really do a thorough fourth step. You know, I was raised to be a good little girl, so I stuffed a lot of anger and feelings and resentment because he didn't show those things. I didn't know I was angry. I really honestly didn't know I was angry until I was here for a while. I remember sitting back there in the meeting when we talk about step four and anger and justify anger and resentment. And I was like, what the heck is it? You know, how do I discover where that is in my life? It took me a while. And I had to get to a place where I was, once I found out I was angry, that I wasn't blaming you, but I could look back at myself. And so then I did fifth, step five. And step six and seven, you know, early on, I really didn't have a very good understanding of them. They've come to mean so much more to me over the past couple of years. It's really, for me, they're kind of the maintenance steps now. Willingness as a principle really runs my life, and I have to stop and ask myself if I find myself fighting my higher power to pray for willingness and just remember that willingness. And then the willingness to, and it's all about change, isn't it? Growing and changing. The willingness leads me to the humility to ask my higher power for help. So I think, and then I'll just go on briefly. Eight and nine, I think, for me, the biggest parts of eight and nine are the living amends that I can make today by the behavior that I show in my life. Towards my family and the people I work with and the people I meet. And with step 10, I like to do mine in the morning because I'm too tired at night. But I heard a gentleman, this is one of the reasons I keep coming back to meetings, because I keep learning new things. And I heard a gentleman at a meeting at Triangle a couple of years ago say, I have to do a 10th step every morning just to know which step I need to be on. And I thought, wow, this is beautiful. Because I love the steps, and I'm always asking myself, what step am I working today? You know, which principle is operating today in my life, or do I need to have operating? So I started using that as kind of my guide with my 10th step. You know, what step, based on my 10th step, what step do I need to be on today? Step 11. Now, my whole life, I was always wondering what was God's will for me. I thought it had to be something big. Maybe, you know, go be a missionary in Africa, right? You know, it's like you got to save the world big. But one of the great miracles and gifts of this program is the simplicity for me. That first off, all I have to do God's will for me as an alcoholic is stay sober and live these principles the best that I can. What a gift. I don't have to figure it out. When I was in early sobriety over at Triangle, I heard a man say in a meeting, I'm one of those people who's always trying to make things. I was one of those people always trying to make things happen the way I wanted them to happen. And he said, my will is what I want to have happen. And God's will is what happens. My will is what I want to have happen. And God's will is just what happens. I've meditated on that over the years many, many, many times. And the way I use that in my life is that all I have to do, besides staying sober and being of help to another alcoholic and practicing these principles, is do the next right thing or do the next thing right. And God's will unfolds in the doing of my life. So I don't have to look for the big stuff. You know, it'll just happen, and the little stuff happens as I go through my life. And that's probably one of the biggest gifts this program has given me, is that I don't have to figure that out. I just have to get up each morning and do those simple things. And I'm doing God's will. As for step 12, with particularly the area of service, my service in AA is really limited to being a sponsor to a few women in my home group and sharing at meetings. I have never been involved in the service structure, but I would never say never. You know, that may be something that happens down the road. But one of the beauties of service to me is the circle. You know, my sponsor helps me, and she tells me I help her. And I tell my sponsees, we help each other. And it all revolves back around, you know, in this beautiful transfer of love and energy in the service of our higher power to each other as alcoholics. And that's a real gift. And my sponsors over the years, I've had three since I've been in the program. I finally decided to get one in my home group a couple years ago because I really didn't see my other sponsor, my NABA sponsor, very much. And I felt it was time. It was a hard decision to make. And I'll just share this. It took me a couple years to make that decision because I was like, is this ego? Is it fear? Why do I need to change? And somebody said to me, well, I would let the need to grow be a guiding principle. And I reflected on that for a while, and that's what led me to my decision to get a sponsor in my home group. And it was really tough. I was about 14 years sober at the time, and I'm like, I have to start all over with somebody. You know, and we barely knew each other. And, you know, it's been one of the most rewarding experiences I've had because she was like, call me every week. So I called her every week. And at first, you know, it was hard to get started again, knowing how to talk to somebody completely new. And over time, this developing relationship and this sharing back and forth has just been such a great gift to me. And I just talked to her a little while ago before I came here, and she's a wonderful lady, and I'm very grateful for that. So I'm going to wrap it up now with I just want to mention, you know, a couple of the gifts of the program that have come my way since I've been sober. And, of course, one of them is my husband, George. And I don't think Match.com would have put us together, but God knew what he was doing. That's him right there. And so we walk this path together one day at a time, and that's a great gift. We laugh a lot in our house. You know, we have a lot of little inside jokes that we can make with each other about recovery. Unfortunately, we're almost, not completely, but almost never sick on the same day. So we don't fight, you know, and we have two cats that we love, and my mom lives with us now, so that's been a real blessing. And then the many friends that I've made in this program are the best people in the world I've ever had in my life. And I'm so grateful for them. And I have a network of women that I talk to, and not just my sponsor, maybe two, right now mainly two others outside of her that are part of my my sharing network that I really can, you know, spill my guts with. And we don't talk to wine. We talk to get into the solution together. That's why we call each other. And that's where we go when we have a conversation. And we feel uplifted by that. And we support each other in our struggles by talking and living in the solution. And they're just as committed to their sobriety as I am. And it's just such a gift. The last thing that I'll mention as a gift of this program is I don't have kids. George doesn't have kids. And, you know, I grew up, not when I moved back from France. I moved next door to a family, a mother and two sons, and a daughter and a son. And we became like family as neighbors. She died at 62 a few years ago of cancer, and it was really heartbreaking for us. But her daughter and I are like sisters. And she's much younger than I am, but we're like family. And because I'm sober, I can participate. We both, George and I, can participate in her family. She's got three little boys. We call them the little geniuses because they're homeschooled. And a couple years ago at Christmas, at Thanksgiving, they said, "Can we call you Uncle George and Aunt Deborah?" You know, I mean, does it get any better than that, really? My life has been enlarged, enriched, because of this program. And, I cannot fully express the depth of my gratitude that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And I have such faith in this program that I do believe that it is here for me and that I can go through anything in life and stay sober. And I've seen other people go through tough things in life and stay sober, that I can do the same. And I'm grateful that God gave us this program. And I'm grateful that you all are here tonight. Thanks for listening. God bless. Stay sober.
Thank you, Deborah. It was really very helpful to me, being new in recovery, so I'm sure it was helpful to others, too. Let's see. I've asked Judy to hand out the chip.
I can do whatever you want. If you want to come up here,
everybody, my name is Judy, and I am involved.
Hey, Judy.
And you are as inspired as I am. That's a part of the reason. You know the story. And nobody hated her. And there were no cue cards. So there is transformation here. So is there anyone who would like to try this way of life one day at a time? We have the light chip. Okay. After 30 days and 30 nights and your eyes cleared up, you can read. It says, and Deborah suggested, it's a he program. Call your sponsor and before you pick up the drink. So we now have somebody to share because the feelings do come up. Anyone for 30 days and 30 nights? Okay. Then we have the three. Look at that. Red. Oh, that's right. It's like a traffic light. We got red, yellow, green.
Okay.
Just because I'm sober doesn't mean this works all the time. So, we have anyone present? Okay. This is... Come on.
There's two notes.
Wonderful. Six notes. Now, we have... I know this one. Okay. Any years or multiples? Well, then it's your higher power for the chips you hold.
Okay. The seventh tradition basket was circulated earlier. For those who missed the opportunity to contribute, whatever you may afford to support our speaker program at NavaClub.org, you will find two convenient volunteering baskets for donations as you exit the room. Thank you for your support. Now it's time for any AA or NAVA Club announcements. Anybody? Mark?
This is Mark. I'm on hold. I'm a teacher of literature staff and a student of liking AA literature and management.
Thank you, Mark. Anybody
else? I'm a teacher of and next Monday night, George will be telling the story right here.
Thank you, sir. I would like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, of reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us for the Lord's Prayer.
Give me all